Chapter 4. The Many Faces of Fear, the Most Primal of Emotions. By the time I met him, Blaze was in big trouble. He had a record of 3 serious bites, one for every year of his life. A strikingly handsome border collie, Blaze was owned by Father Murray, an 80-year-old Irish priest straight out of Central Casting. They made quite a pair, Blaze with a generous ruff of black and white fur, Father Murray with dancing blue eyes, rosy cheeks, and an angelic sweetness that melted my heart the minute he walked into my office. But this wasn't going to be a fun consultation. I knew that before it started. A mutual friend had talked Father Murray into coming to see me, sick with worry about the future of both man and dog. The two adored each other, but Blaze had become so aggressive to visitors that no one could get out of their car in Father Murray's driveway without being bitten. Walking into the house was out of the question. The problem was compounded by the fact that Father Murray was so hard of hearing I had to yell, even in my small office, so he could hear me. When visitors came to his isolated old house deep in the country, he couldn't hear the car drive up or the knocking on his door. His only clue that company had arrived was Blaze charging toward the window, barking so aggressively he became almost hysterical. In short order, it became clear that Blaze was a danger to society. Even Father Murray was at risk, given the extremity of Blaze's behavior and the chance that he'd lash out at anyone in his frenzy. Father Murray would have done anything to rehabilitate Blaze, but the chance that he could manage a successful rehabilitation was almost nil. Blaze was a young, healthy dog bred to work hard all day, with boundless energy that went in all the wrong directions. Father Murray may have been active for his age, but I'd be hard-pressed to describe him as hardy or agile. His hearing problem and his isolation in the country complicated the situation. If he couldn't rehabilitate Blaze himself, the only alternatives were rehoming him or having him euthanized. I found myself forced to scream words difficult even to whisper. I said euthanize, desperately trying to communicate with this dear old man who loved his dog as much as life itself. The thought of giving up Blaze devastated Father Murray. That's the only way I can describe it. He began to cry in that deep, primal way we do when all our inhibitions have been overrun by emotion. I sat helpless at my desk while this dear old man sobbed in my office until, in a classic case of emotion trumping logic, I offered to take Blaze and try to rehabilitate him myself. As soon as I said it, I knew it was crazy. Adding another dog into my already busy life was the last thing I needed, but I took Blaze home, wrapping my life and the life of my dogs around his rehabilitation for the next 3 months. I'm glad I did. Although I've asked the office manager to carefully screen consultations with adorable elderly priests for a while. The Many Faces of Fear. Poor Blaze. There he was, terrifying visitors with his panicked barks and his flashing teeth, when all along he was terrified himself. Blaze was afraid of unfamiliar people, and rather than hide in the back of the house like some dogs, Blaze expressed his fear with that age-old, "I'm going to get you before you get me" philosophy. Dogs like Blaze remind me of scraggly bearded hermits who threaten visitors with shotguns, in the belief that anyone unfamiliar must be dangerous. Fear in dogs can be expressed in a multitude of ways, from cowering in the corner to lunging at visitors, but it's the emotion behind a multitude of behavioral problems. Like Blaze, lots of dogs behave problematically because they're afraid of people. Other dogs are afraid of members of their own species and are defensively aggressive when encountering other dogs on neighborhood walks. I'm using aggressive in the popular sense when it labels any dog who growls, snaps, nips, or bites. Be aware, however, that the strict definition of aggression is an offensive versus defensive action coupled with intent to cause harm, and thus does not include growling out of fear to try to defend yourself. They may look scary when they're barking and lunging, especially if their behavior is directed toward your own dog, but sometimes all that drama is just a desperate attempt to keep the other dog away. While fear motivates some dogs to growl, snap, or bite, it causes others to melt into pathetic puddles or to buzz up into panic-stricken, whirling dervishes. Separation anxiety, the fear of being alone, and noise phobias can lead to some horrific behavioral problems in dogs. Missy, the Weimaraner, was so afraid to be left alone that she went through a plate glass window and carved a road map of lacerations into her back. In 10 short minutes after a truck backfired on the adjacent highway, Frito, the Golden Retriever, did $10,000 worth of damage to his owner's apartment. The consequences of phobias in dogs are highly reminiscent of phobias in people and are yet another reminder of how much of our emotional life we share with dogs. Fear may cause a lot of problems in both species, but the good news is that there's a lot we can do to alleviate the problems caused by it. We can't cure every fear-related problem in dogs any more than we can in people, but a little bit of knowledge can go a long way. That's why this chapter will begin, as will each of the chapters on three of our most primal emotions, fear, anger, and happiness, with information about the biology of the emotion. Next, we'll talk about fear from three different perspectives. One, the genetics of fear, and how some brains are hardwired to be overly reactive to the potential of danger. Two, early development, during which dogs can be programmed to be fearful of unfamiliar things or overreactive to stress. And three, learning and experience, and how dogs can be traumatized just as people can. Each of these factors can influence how much fear an adult dog experiences, so it's useful to understand them if you want to understand fearful dogs. Fear is designed to be aversive, and it's an emotion most of us don't want our dogs to experience, except as part of learning to keep themselves safe. In this chapter, we'll talk about the influence of each of the three factors, and in the next chapter, we'll talk about practical and effective methods to treat behavior problems based on fear. Fear. Don't leave home without it. Surely, fear must be the most universal of emotions, given its importance to survival. Without fear, even civilized urban dwellers wouldn't live to pass on any of their genes because they'd stroll in front of buses and forget to lock their doors at night. People who experience little fear are at great risk. Individuals born with no pain receptors in their skin have a hard time learning to be afraid of harmful things like fire and electricity, so they live far more dangerous lives than the rest of us. Animals who don't feel fear aren't going to live long enough to reproduce. It's as simple as that. The value of this emotion is evident in studies in which mice have had their amygdalas, those almond-shaped centers of fear and anger in the brain, mechanically stimulated. The mice fearlessly attacked any animal brought into their cage, including fully clawed cats. This is not a good strategy for a defenseless animal that weighs less than 2 ounces. Fear, the brain's way of protecting the body, is one of the most ubiquitous and primitive of emotions. Puppies develop their first fear period right around the age they become fully mobile, which is the first time that a lack of caution could get them killed. Given all we know about behavior and the brain, it's hard to argue that complicated animals like mammals aren't able to feel fear. While more complex emotions like pride, shame, and love may be controversial, almost all biologists are convinced that human and non-human mammals experience fear in ways at least somewhat comparable. Temple Grandin says, "Fear is so bad for animals, I think it's worse than pain." Although highly functional and with a PhD in animal science, Temple Grandin is autistic. She argues, reasonably, that the biology of fear and pain is more similar in autistic people and animals than in typical people and animals, and that as an autistic person, she has centered her life around the management of her intense fears. She sees those fears reflected in the lives of other animals, especially herbivores, like cattle and sheep, and she supports her argument with good, solid biology. One of the differences between autistic and typical people is a difference in the activity level of the prefrontal cortex, one of the areas of the brain involved in controlling fear. A high level of prefrontal cortical function, found in most humans, allows one to control fear, but is associated with higher levels of pain. Lower levels of the same function are found in non-human animals and autistic people. They correlate with reduced pain perception, but higher levels of fear. Fight or flight, but only after freeze. As a universal emotion, fear has predictable consequences on an animal's behavior. These patterns can be useful to dog owners in that they can help us decode our dog's emotions. Imagine you're walking down the street with your dog and suddenly there's a loud crashing noise right behind you. This information, very, very loud noise, very, very close, begins its usual path to the thinking part of your brain, but on its way, the signal runs through the amygdala, both in your brain and the brain of your dog, which takes over in a potential crisis before the cortex can evaluate the situation. The amygdala signals emergency in a split second and initiates a flood of messages that prepare your body for action. No time for analysis here. Every millisecond counts if you're in serious danger. React first and ask questions later has kept many an animal alive, whether the danger was from a predator, a tree falling in the forest, or a car careening onto the sidewalk behind you. We're all familiar with that visceral feeling of panic flooding through our bodies. Our hearts beat faster and our blood pressure rises, accompanied by that hard-to-describe feeling of tightening and fluttering in our chests. Something similar must flow through your dog's body, too, because she has all the same initial physiological responses that you have when she's startled. Remember, the thinking cortex, the part of you that is very different from your dog's, hasn't yet been engaged, so there's no reason to believe that at this point your dog's response would be any different from your own. We call this universal response of the body to potential danger the fight-or-flight syndrome, but to be accurate, we should include freeze in the equation. Freezing, ever so briefly, is the most common response to an emergency signal from the brain. In the absence of information, it can be hard to know what to do. Run? But what if you end up running toward the danger? Attack? But is that really your best choice? Most animals freeze, even if just for a millisecond, before they decide whether to stand their ground or run away. This is an involuntary response in which the inhibitory part of the nervous system, the parasympathetic system, calls a screaming halt to everything for a microscopically brief moment of reflection. Remember those extended freezes we talked about in Chapter 2? Now you know why they might be a signal of danger. A dog frozen in place over his chew toy could be feeling afraid or angry, but either way, his body is ramped up for action. Don't be fooled by the stillness of a dog who isn't moving. His body may be still and silent on the outside, but inside, it's a cauldron of activity. Stiff-postured dogs always remind me, bear with me here, of submarines in old war movies. If the camera is looking at the sub from the outside, all seems peaceful and calm as the sub glides soundlessly through the water. Inside, however, is a whirlwind of activity, with alarm whistles shrieking and sailors scrambling in response to an oncoming threat. Dogs who react by freezing in place may look passive on the outside, but they are usually highly aroused on the inside. These freezes can vary in duration, from eternally long standoffs between two stiff-legged male dogs to the briefest of pauses to warn you away from a chew toy. Once you start looking for them, you'll see them everywhere, and once you recognize the long, obvious ones, your ability to notice the short ones will rapidly improve. Dogs who freeze are both sending out signals and awaiting more information, so how you respond will make a big difference in their subsequent behavior. However, before we talk about the best way to respond to your dog's fears, it's useful to look at the factors that influence how they are experienced and expressed. Let's talk about genetics first, not only because it comes first chronologically, but also because it often seems to be the least understood. Let me start with a story about Tulip. The inheritance of security systems. Frozen in place, as if in terror, Tulip stood at the doorway to the living room, in the classic expression of a frightened dog. Her mouth was clamped shut, and her eyes were huge. For the longest time, I don't think she even took a breath. Tulip is a Great Pyrenees, a breed developed to guard sheep from wolves in the Pyrenees Mountains, and I have no doubt she'd fight off a pack of them if they went after my sheep. Without any training and protection, Tulip watches over the sheep and the farmhouse, and bless her, over me. Normally, as quiet and sweet as a spring afternoon, Tulip has fearlessly leapt into the fray when something was in danger, whether that something was a sheep, another dog, or a person. Fearless isn't the word that came to mind when my big, brave guard dog stood stock still in the living room doorway. Tulip was so frightened by what she saw that she wouldn't enter the living room for hours, and for days afterward would enter only through a different door. You might think there had been a wolf in the house, or at least a shifty-eyed stranger who appeared out of nowhere, but the problem wasn't that dramatic. The problem was an empty cardboard box sitting in the middle of the floor. Tulip stared at it, stiff and immobile, for 2 or 3 seconds, and then let out a series of barks that raised the house off its foundation. She barked as though we were all in peril of losing our lives. The cat dashed up the stairs, pursued by phantom demons. The border collies ran into the room, Luke and his daughter Lassie alarm barking as they scrambled across the slippery kitchen floor. I ran to the window, expecting to see a truck the size of Connecticut in the driveway or a raging bull on the lawn. Nothing. Just a box. An empty cardboard box. I'd bought a new VCR that afternoon and had left the box it came in on the floor. That's what caused Tulip to first freeze and then bark as if we were all about to die. After I finally realized the source of Tulip's concern, I tried to coax her over to it. She planted her feet and raised her head like a frightened horse. I threw food by the box. She wouldn't touch it. She wouldn't even take a piece of lamb that I offered in another room, out of sight of the killer cardboard box. I carried the box to the garage and flattened it down into sheets of cardboard. When Tulip walked by it later that night, she paid it virtually no attention. But the living room was a different story altogether. For days afterward, she'd hesitate before entering it, leaning her body backward while she stretched her nose forward to investigate. She wouldn't enter it at all through the same door she'd used when she first discovered the box. That wasn't a crisis. She could use another door. But that door wasn't very handy, and it somehow seemed absurd that a certified applied animal behaviorist couldn't get her own dog through the room's most convenient doorway. Tulip goes in and out of the living room now as if nothing had ever happened. It took a few days of classical counter conditioning and an old horse trader trick I had learned years ago at a stable. Because Tulip was comfortable going out of the room once she was inside it, I simply walked her one step out the doorway, turned her around in a circle 3 times in the middle of the doorway, and then walked back in without taking a pause. After you've spun around in a couple of circles, the difference between inside and outside gets pretty blurred, so this, along with the addition of some particularly tasty treats as she entered, helped Tulip put aside her fears and start acting like the living room was, well, a living room. But why did she react with such drama in the first place? No doubt her reaction to the killer cardboard box was influenced by learning and early experience. As a sheep guarding dog, Tulip lived in the barn for the first 3 years of her life, a place devoid of VCRs and cardboard boxes. She'd only been living in the house for 6 or 8 months when the killer cardboard box arrived. Now that she's lived in the house for 7 years, the arrival of a new box or a piece of furniture might elicit a good sniff, but it won't produce signs of alarm. However, it wasn't just a lack of experience that affected her response. Like most dogs bred for guarding, Tulip is extremely reactive to changes in routine. This makes a lot of sense when you think about it. It can be hard to know whether something new is dangerous or not, so for the one in charge of security, its very novelty makes it worthy of cautious attention. We all intuitively understand this to some extent, but security experts learn to be especially sensitive to change. We are often warned to watch for anything out of the ordinary in times of danger, so it makes sense that dogs bred to be 4-footed security guards would have similar tendencies. Some dogs take this to extremes. Bo Peep barked for 2 days when I moved the farm truck from the right side of the barn to the left. But at normal levels, caution is useful. It keeps wild animals safe more often than not, and so it tends to be a trait that hangs around in the gene pool. No wonder, then, that the tendency to be fearful around unfamiliar animals and objects, often called shyness by biologists, has a high degree of heritability in dogs as well as in people. Lots of people are surprised that their dog's fears of strangers can, at least in part, be explained by inheritance. Behaviorists and trainers hear, almost on a daily basis, that a client's dog must have been abused because she reacts so fearfully to strangers. However, many of these dogs are just shy, and they aren't any more comfortable around unfamiliar strangers than shy people are. Shyness exemplifies one of the many ways that genetics and brain function can influence how a dog experiences fear. This seems to be a concept to which we're resistant, although we have no problem associating other traits, like artistic talent or the gift of gab, with an individual's genetic inheritance. We all seem happy to accept that physical characteristics like eye color, coat color, and size are inherited, and that genetics influence certain types of canine behavior, such as retrieving and herding. It turns out that genes also influence how fearful or reactive dogs are, so part of how your dog behaves to visitors was already hardwired within her when you brought her home as a pup. Genetics and fear. We're starting to understand a lot about how genes affect fearful behavior. One of the greatest influences of our genetic heritage is on which parts of our brains are most easily activated. We know that different versions of genes, the architects that draw the blueprints of our body, create different activity levels in the amygdala and other fear-related areas of the brain. For example, a study in 2002 found that one of the genes that help regulate levels of serotonin in the brain comes in two different versions. One version, interacting with certain experiences during early development, leads to too much serotonin, a neurotransmitter that in normal amounts helps to soothe and calm the activity of the amygdala. But more isn't always good, and too much serotonin sends the amygdala into overdrive. Overwhelmed with too much serotonin, the amygdala overreacts, causing a high incidence of anxiety disorders. More evidence about the influence of genetics on fearful behavior comes from a surprising link between temperament and whether you are right-handed, left-handed, or ambidextrous. Researchers have found that people who express no preference for using one hand or the other have higher than expected levels of generalized anxiety disorders. A recent study on noise phobia in dogs found similar results. Dogs who used either paw to stabilize a stuffed toy so that they could lick food out of it had a higher frequency of noise phobias than dogs who were right or left pawed. Handedness is inherited in humans, and we have every reason to believe it is in dogs, too. If being ambidextrous is associated with an increased risk of generalized anxiety disorder, then the disorder itself is most likely passed on genetically as well. More evidence relating to brain function and fearfulness comes from studies of people with autism. Autistic people respond to faces as if to threats, not because they don't recognize them, but because autistic people's amygdalas are always overactive. We don't know exactly what causes autism, but there's no question that it has a lot to do with the function and chemistry of the brain, matters influenced both by genetics and, as we saw in the last chapter, early development. Individuals with a variety of anxiety disorders also have overactive amygdalas, and this relationship between genetics, the workings of the brain, and the experience of fear is just as pronounced in other animals, including our dogs. A good example of the interplay between genetics and fear is the type of fear that biologists call shyness, one of the many aspects of life we share with dogs. Anyone who's ever had to walk into a crowded party, not knowing a soul in the room, can empathize with a dog cowering behind her owner's leg at doggy daycare. Our level of discomfort around unfamiliar people varies. Sales reps are known for their lack of it. But most of us have felt shy at some point in our lives. How often and how intensely you feel shy turns out to be influenced by your genetics, just as it is in your dog. What's different about this type of fear in people and dogs is the way it's expressed. We think of shy people as passive, retiring folks who stay in the background, speaking quietly, if at all, and avoiding the spotlight. However, to dog trainers and biologists, shyness refers to a specific type of emotion, the fear of the unfamiliar. What action a dog takes in response to this fear can vary widely, from hiding behind the couch to the canine equivalent of pulling out a shotgun when a car drives up. Do I know you? Although the fear of meeting new people is common in our species, many dog owners seem surprised, even shocked, when their dog behaves one way to the family and another way to strangers. "But he's so sweet," they say almost pleadingly in a consultation, while their dog sits in the corner and avoids me. He may be hiding his head behind the chair, or he may be growling under his breath because he's trapped in a room with a stranger, but both responses are motivated by fear. I have no trouble believing that their dog is exuberantly friendly to the family, but that doesn't mean he will be to people he doesn't know. Shy people behave differently around their close friends than they do with strangers. Why should dogs be any different? Even so, it seems hard for some people to understand that the dog who is sweet and loving to them may not behave that way toward everyone. No one knows this better than delivery workers, whose amygdalas light up when they hear the words, "Oh, don't worry, he's just fine," as a household dog tries to lunge through the screen door toward them. Fine often means the dog is wonderful with the family, but it doesn't say much about how he behaves toward anyone else. Dogs sort the world into familiar and unfamiliar, and you can't understand dogs if you don't understand that. Of course, we humans don't see the world all that differently. If you woke up in the middle of the night and found someone standing in your bedroom, wouldn't it make a difference if he was a trusted friend instead of a complete stranger? It's understandable that people have a hard time equating growls and bites with fear, especially the kind of fear that biologists and animal behaviorists call shyness. We're used to associating shyness with timidity, so it's hard to look at what appears to be an aggressive dog and think of her as shy. After all, shy people don't usually attack visitors. Why would shy dogs? There are probably many reasons that dogs and people express their discomfort around strangers differently. Surely, one of them is that adult humans are often able to avoid social encounters that make them nervous, whereas our dogs are often not given the choice. There they are, tied up in the front yard or trapped on a leash, unable to avoid contact with people they don't know. Even if they do have a choice, dogs have no idea who is an acceptable visitor and who isn't. How are they to know that the stranger at the door is delivering a package rather than threatening the den? With the rational thinking parts of their brains radically smaller and less efficient than ours, dogs simply can't think through all the complexities of human social interactions and talk themselves down from feeling afraid. If they have what is called an active defense reflex, then they're going to go after what scares them rather than run away from it. It's also helpful to note that although most of us think of shy people as being timid, some shy people report that they become overly assertive to mask their fears. Melvin Belli, the flashy American attorney, said he became flamboyant to hide his own shyness. Here's a passage written by a boisterous woman who describes herself as very shy. "I barge in, hog conversations, rattle on endlessly, making an ass and nuisance of myself, appearing to be insensitive to others, all for the same reasons others attempt to fade into the woodwork. My underlying terror of being in public is no less, and my problems are no less serious than those of wallflowers." Statements like these make me think of dogs who barrel into my office and leap all over me, the desk, and anything else that gets in their way. These dogs are full of energy, but they are as quick to jump on the furniture as they are to jump onto you. You get no sense of connection with these dogs, and if you look past the exuberant activity, they don't seem to have any interest in relating to you at all. I've come to think of them as frenetic rather than friendly, and increasingly I find myself wondering whether some of them are the Melvin Bellies of dogdom. However it's expressed, there's little question that the fear of the unfamiliar is a common trait in the animal world. One early study on shyness in humans found that 80% of respondents described themselves as shy at some point in their life, and 40% of them said they were still shy as adults. 4% said they were shy all the time, in all new situations. The study showed that shyness was relatively common, but at that time, we didn't know how it developed or how much of it was learned and how much inherited. People long ago came to suspect that this type of fear was heritable in humans, but the early studies were confounded by the influence a shy mother has on her baby. The evidence was overwhelming that shy mothers tended to have shy children, but until researchers looked at adopted babies, we couldn't separate out nature from nurture. It made sense that shy mothers would behave differently than bold ones, and that in itself might be enough to influence a child's behavior. In 1985, researchers answered the question by comparing babies raised by their biological mothers to babies raised by adoptive mothers. All the babies had been born to shy mothers, but the adopted infants were raised by mothers who were not shy. Such studies, called cross-fostering studies when performed on animals, help us sort out the influence of genetics from the influence of the mother during early development. Although the mother's behaviors did indeed affect the children, shy mothers raised the shyest babies. There was also a strong genetic effect. Infants born to shy mothers were still somewhat shy, even when raised by moms who weren't. Advocates of the nurture side of the equation argued against the influence of nature, genetics, for decades, but countless studies have made clear that nature has a profound effect on whether an individual will tend to be shy or bold. The same result has been found in many animals, including our primate relatives. Stephen Suomi, a primatologist at the National Institutes of Health, has spent decades studying shyness and has found that about 15% to 20% of several monkey species are excessively fearful of novel individuals or situations. Shyness has even been found to be heritable in one of the world's hardest working animals, the laboratory rat. Perhaps you've heard about the work reported a few decades ago on maize bright and maize dull rats, in which researchers selectively bred rats depending on how quickly they could run a maze. In just a few generations, they'd bred a group of rats who were able to move through a complicated maze in no time, especially compared with the dull group, who were bred for their lackluster performance. Only there was one problem. It turned out that bright and dull rats, read smart and stupid, although the researchers were too gracious to use those terms, weren't at all different in their ability to solve problems. The dull rats were simply afraid of new environments, and when placed in one, were less likely to explore than the bright ones were. The bright ones may have won blue ribbons in the laboratory, but they'd be the first ones eaten by a hawk in the wild. A good reminder of why shyness tends to hang around in the gene pool. A dog's fear of the unfamiliar. Fear of the unfamiliar may not be blatantly obvious in laboratory rats, but it can be easy to spot in the dogs that live in our homes. We've all known dogs who were a bit cautious around visitors or who were afraid of new places. This tendency to be cautious around unfamiliar things is as strongly influenced by genetics in dogs as it is in people. Studies done as early as 1944 supported the idea that the fear of strangers can be inherited in dogs. The researchers found that out of 178 dogs bred in one laboratory, 46% were extremely shy. This surprisingly large percentage turned out to be due to the disproportionate influence of one extremely shy basset hound bitch, who produced 59 of the puppies in the study, 43 of whom were shy and unfriendly. Another study in 1958 reported significant breed differences in fearful responses to novel objects, for example, a mechanical snake or an inflated balloon, finding that individuals of breeds such as collies, German shepherds, and corgis were most likely to be wary of unfamiliar things, while boxers, Scotties, and Boston terriers were the boldest. The famous 20-year study done by Scott and Fuller on the genetics of dog behavior confirmed that shyness, although strongly influenced by experience during early development, was also affected by genetics. More recently, some researchers have found that fearfulness was the one personality trait that could be predicted by puppy temperament tests, if the tests were given at 12 weeks instead of the more common 7 or 8 weeks. The research also found that the tests were most predictive if given at 6 months of age, a good reminder that heritable traits don't necessarily appear in the first few months of life. After all, well-bred sheep-herding dogs, whose stalking behavior around sheep is as hardwired as walking, often don't turn on to stalk until adolescence, even late adolescence. I have always found it amazing that an inherited trait like the Border Collie eye was so variable in the timing of its first appearance. You can see it in some 8-week-old puppies, but others pay no attention to sheep until one day, even as late as 14 months of age, they happen to glance at the sheep, and in an instant, their heads drop and their eyes focus like a heat-seeking missile system. Eye doesn't develop step by step. Rather, it's as though someone turned a light switch from off to on. All this is to remind us that just because a behavior is influenced by genetics doesn't mean you're going to see it in an 8-week-old pup, although a tendency to be fearful appears to be relatively stable through time. In the last few decades, scientists have capitalized on the genetic influence of behavior by studying a line of genetically nervous pointers. These dogs are so shy they can't tolerate any human interaction. They freeze and tremble when petted, and no amount of loving kindness can calm their fears. The study has confirmed the genetic basis of their behavior. Normal dogs raised by nervous moms did not become nervous themselves, while dogs from nervous mothers were fearful no matter who raised them. Currently, Karen Overall and colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania are studying the neurophysiology of some of these dogs, and another researcher, Greg Ackland at Cornell, is studying a line of more typically shy Siberian Huskies. The goal of these projects is to teach us more about the biology of fear and anxiety in both people and dogs, and they remind us yet again how much of our emotional life we share with dogs. Dogs, wolves, and shyness. Although the consequences of shyness can be a serious problem in both people and dogs, domestic dogs are actually much less shy than their closest relatives, wolves. Wolves are notoriously shy, so much so that researchers used to crawl into wolf dens and handle the puppies while the parents hid in fear. That kind of disruption, done by researchers to check on the pups, is avoided at all costs now, since the parents may be so concerned about the safety of their pups that they'll risk moving the den, or may be so stressed that they'll abandon the pups altogether. These are the same animals who will fight off grizzly bears to protect their pups, so bravery is not the issue. Familiarity is. Remember, fear of the unfamiliar improves your chances of staying alive if you live in the wild. Domestic dogs, like many domestic animals, show a much higher tolerance for coping with unfamiliar things than do their wild counterparts. That's one of the defining characteristics of domestication. No one has illustrated this more clearly than the Russian biologist Dmitry Belyev, who selectively bred only the tamest and friendliest of Russian fur foxes. Not only was he able to create foxes that acted for all the world like domestic dogs, he found that the friendliest foxes, whom he called the domesticated elite, were physiologically different from the shyer, wilder ones. The docile foxes had a delayed fear period during development, and their levels of cortisol, one of the products of an active amygdala, were lower. Shyness, or the lack of it, is the basis for a popular and very reasonable hypothesis about the evolution of the domestic dog. In dogs, a startling new understanding of canine origin, behavior, and evolution, Ray and Lorna Coppinger argued that dogs are derived from a subset of wolves who were bold enough to forage on the outskirts of human settlements. The shyest wolves stayed away and remained wolves as we know them today. The boldest ones hung around humans and, through both natural and artificial selection, became dogs. Perhaps that's one of the reasons it is so hard for us to equate human shyness with the behavior of our dogs. So many dogs seem oblivious to social stress, with the hardy boldness of a door-to-door salesman. But as we've already noted, a trait like shyness has a lot of value, so it's hard to eliminate from an entire species. It's no surprise, then, that many of our dogs retain varying degrees of it. Genetics. Blueprints written in pencil. No matter how much research supports the influence of genetics on personality traits, like shyness, there is still resistance in some quarters to the idea that there are genetically influenced personality traits that remain stable over an individual's lifetime. True, some studies show that experiences early in development can wipe out the effect of genetics. For instance, genetically shy rhesus monkeys can end up as functionally normal adults if they are cross-fostered with the right mothers. But other studies suggest that personality can be stable over time. Children who were categorized as timid around unfamiliar people showed similar behavioral and neurological responses to the sight of unfamiliar faces when they became adults. Perhaps some of the resistance to acknowledging the impact of genes on fearful behavior comes from the belief that genetic means unchangeable. A book about shyness in people written by the psychologist Philip Zimbardo in the 1970s suggests that acknowledging a genetic effect on shyness is tantamount to assuming that all shy people are doomed to a life of fear and anxiety. He calls it the born-to-be-a-loser approach. The same assumptions appear today in articles in popular magazines and newspapers. I read one recently that suggested if shyness is genetic, then it is permanent and can't be influenced. I shouldn't be surprised, then, when my clients ask, with drawn faces and held breaths, "Is it genetic?" As if genetic were a curse that no magic potion could cure. Yet, that's not how genes influence a behavior as complicated as shyness or aggression. Think of genetics in these cases as creating a predisposition or a tendency to behave a certain way. Like a driverless car rolling down a slight incline, these tendencies can be influenced by someone who hops in and puts on the brakes, or can cruise along on their own, picking up steam as they flow downhill, headed for who knows what. How much you can affect a trait like shyness depends on the intensity of the individual genetic contribution to it. No one can cure the genetically shy pointers. The wiring in their brains is so extreme it can't respond to any type of treatment. That level of genetic influence, however, is rare. More often, one can do a lot to increase an animal's level of comfort. It's just hard to know how far you can take them until you try. It's also good to remember that you can only work with what you've got. Extremely fearful individuals may learn to be comfortable around strangers, but they're not going to love selling widgets door to door. The same is true for dogs. I worked with Cato, a Great Dane puppy who was so frightened of strangers that at 12 weeks of age, he growled at me when I entered the house. Lucky for Cato, he was owned by Brenda Skidmore, now a professional dog trainer, who went into socialization superdrive when Cato was still a young pup. Cato lived the life of a social butterfly for his first year, never being overwhelmed, but given frequent opportunities to meet new people in a variety of environments. Cato learned to associate strangers with treats, and because of it, he grew into a dog who was gracious and polite. As an adult, Cato was quiet and reserved, and his owners were wise enough not to try to turn him into Larry the Labrador. However, his fear never evolved into something dangerous, which it well could have if the Skidmores hadn't taken that first growl seriously and taught him to associate strangers with yummy treats. Most of us have a personal intuitive sense of the interplay between an inborn personality trait, like shyness, and the influence of practice and experience. Shy individuals may make great strides in overcoming their timidity, even becoming great public speakers, but they're probably not going to become nightclub hosts. Keep that in mind if you're breeding dogs or if you're picking out a puppy. You can only work with what you've got, and what you've got, a set of genes wrapped up in silky fur and floppy ears, was created a long time ago in the heritage of your dog's ancestors. Buyer beware. I don't want to give the impression that shyness is always a behavioral disaster. A little bit of caution about new things can actually make a dog easier to manage, especially as an adolescent. It's the dogs with extreme shyness who suffer so much and who can cause untold suffering to their human family. Shyness doesn't combine well with some other genetically mediated traits. Dogs who are shy, along with being territorial, overreactive, and quick to use their mouths, are at risk of biting visitors who enter your house without knocking. The last thing most of us want is a dog who defines anything new as a crisis and feels he has to confront it with his mouth. Rather than run away from the killer cardboard box, Tulip could have charged at it, which would have been the response of a dog who goes on offense in response to her fears, rather than on defense. I'm eternally grateful that Tulip is on the lookout for anything new or different at the farm, and that in over 10 years, she's never taken it upon herself to charge into battle unless an animal was being physically attacked. Thus, the cardboard boxes at Red Start Farm remain safe, unless they take it upon themselves to attack me, another dog, or my sheep. I'm lucky that Tulip has the ideal combination of shyness, protectiveness, and docility to welcome visitors but protect the farm from danger. That's not always the case, and we do well to remember it. Shyness in dogs can and does combine with other personality traits to turn into aggression. That important fact of biology requires more attention than it presently gets. Far too many puppies are produced from shy parents with little regard for the effects on the dog and on the family in the dog's new home. If you're looking to buy or adopt a puppy, ask yourself whether an adult version of a shy pup is going to respond to her fears on offense or on defense. That's the difference between a dog who hides behind your legs when the mailman hands you a package and a dog who lunges out to bite him. You can get genetics on your side by using the information in Chapter 2 to read the emotional expressions of the puppies in a litter and by evaluating their relatives. Most important, you can obtain a puppy from a reliable, responsible source. Keep in mind that it's not just shy parents who can produce shy puppies. You can breed shy pups from parents who seem relatively bold if one of their parents was a bit shy. Remember that shyness is a conservative trait, so it's going to hang around in the gene pool, even if only somewhere in the background. If you're the one doing the breeding, be sure, before you decide on mating, that you've learned about the behavior of the entire line, not just the behavior of the parents. If you're the one doing the buying, do enough research to discover if your potential pup's parents, grandparents, and aunts and uncles ever had any problem with excessive shyness. This information is impossible to obtain if the parents have lived in kennels all their lives. In that case, nothing ever changes, so how can you know how the dogs will cope with something new or different? This is one of the many reasons why we should all be actively fighting against the plague of puppy mills, from which millions of dogs are sold to unsuspecting people with no regard for the disposition of the parents. Bringing up puppy. The story of Blaze, the dog who began this chapter, is a perfect example of the importance of early development on fearful behavior in dogs. Blaze was aggressive to people because he was afraid of them, but in this case, the cause wasn't his genetics. Blaze warmed up so fast in my office and seemed so happy to be around people once he relaxed that it seemed impossible to believe he was hardwired to be fearful. I suspected that Blaze was afraid of visitors because he'd seen so few of them, especially during the phase of development called the critical period of socialization. Blaze had grown up in an isolated house in the middle of nowhere. Rather than being genetically shy, Blaze had had little exposure to people as he was growing up, and therefore he saw anyone who was unfamiliar as a threat. As he matured, he began to act on those fears, desperately trying to protect Father Murray and the house from invasion by aliens. Blaze's story exemplifies how both nature, genes, and nurture, development and learning, play essential roles in behavior. If Blaze had been well socialized, I doubt very much that he would have become aggressive. If he hadn't inherited a certain amount of friendliness, I doubt he ever could have been rehabilitated. However, he was also hardwired to be exceptionally reactive, and he had a lot of trouble keeping himself from becoming over-aroused. The combination of these factors created both the Blaze of the past, who would have bitten you, and the Blaze of today, who'll lick your face and welcome you to his new farm. We'll talk in the next chapter about how that turnaround happened, but for now, it's worthwhile to talk about how Blaze's aggression to visitors could have been prevented in the first place. The period of early development has a profound effect on an individual's level of fearfulness about the world. We've learned that warm, supportive parents lead to bolder, more confident children. We know that genetically shy monkeys and human babies can be brought out of their shells by being cross-fostered with attentive mothers who provide what's called a secure attachment base. We talked at length in Chapter 3 about the impact of an enriched environment with respect to a dog's ability to cope with change as an adult, and this effect is equally important on a dog's tendency to be fearful or bold. If you think about it, an enriched environment is not that different from a changing environment. Even a complex environment stops being enriching if it never changes. You can't have something new without change. That's why any properly enriched environment includes chances to meet new people and dogs. That's why both puppies and children need to be introduced to enough new people and dogs that meeting individuals who are unfamiliar becomes familiar itself. Both breeders and puppy buyers will have happier dogs if they are mindful of the importance of socialization. I mention breeders because we know that the primary sensitive period of socialization begins as early as 3 weeks of age and is over as early as 12 weeks. Good breeders invite lots of friends, who have washed their hands and left their shoes outside, thank you, to interact with the pups. Good puppy raisers do the same and take the pup out and about to meet people and polite, healthy dogs of all descriptions, making sure that the interactions are good ones. Effective socialization creates positive experiences that enable your pup to feel comfortable with the variety of people and dogs, and to learn that strangers, no matter how many paws they have, are a good thing. Puppy socialization classes can be a great addition to a socialization program. The good ones get you started on lots of fun and practical training exercises, while introducing your pup to a variety of other shapes and sizes of dogs. Be cautious, though, about puppy classes in which all the pups are thrown together in a mosh pit of activity, with instructors blithely saying, "Oh, it's great for puppies to learn to work things out for themselves." Puppies work things out just like young children on playgrounds do, with little regard for emotional control or the social niceties of life. There's a reason that an adult is always assigned to monitor the playground at an elementary school. Otherwise, we'd have Lord of the Flies acted out at schools all across the country. Unregulated puppy classes can create the same dynamic by reinforcing bullies. Yes, even young puppies can act like bullies, and traumatizing some of the more timid puppies. The problems associated with unregulated puppy classes are a good reminder that socialization doesn't mean throwing your pup into the deep end of social interaction and assuming he'll learn to swim. As we'll see in the next section, that can cause more problems than it solves. Be sure that your pup's socialization process is a series of positive experiences, not a series of negative ones. A little bit goes a long way. Recently, I saw a couple at a busy, noisy farmer's market with a terrified boxer puppy in tow. "Oh, he's fine," they said. There's that phrase again. "We thought this would be a great place to get him socialized." It didn't seem like such a great place to me, and I don't think the puppy thought so either. The tiny puppy was so scared he was trembling. Surrounded by hordes of noisy adults and screaming children reaching to pet him, the poor pup was overwhelmed. He was learning, all right. He was learning to be deathly afraid of people. Unfortunately, this scene is all too common, and ironically is produced by people with the best of intentions. Too many puppies are inadvertently traumatized through a misunderstanding of what a healthy socialization process entails. Rather than being gradually exposed to different environments, pups end up traumatized by being thrown into scary situations that are over their heads. A healthy period of development isn't about any kind of exposure. It's about exposure that allows puppies to learn about life at their own pace. Not long ago, an 8-week-old puppy, let's call him Tigger, visited my office. His little jaw was swollen from a serious bite from another dog, although that didn't stop him from cheerily greeting all the people in the room. As bold as the pup seemed, I was concerned about his reaction to other dogs in the future. What effect would a bad bite, the poor thing's jaw was broken, have on the pup's relation to other dogs? As luck would have it, Lassie was in another office, and I knew I could count on her to be quiet and polite around a fragile young puppy. I wanted to start creating good experiences for Tigger in case his earlier trauma had taught him that dogs were dangerous. As I feared, Tigger took one look at Lassie and flattened in fear, with the corners of his little mouth pulled back and his eyes rounded like frisbees. The worst thing we could have done was let Lassie run to him when he was trapped in a small room, so as soon as I saw his expression, I asked Lassie to lie down on the other side of the room, and we let Tigger run back to Mom. Secure beside his new two-legged mama, Tigger stared at Lassie as if transfixed while the humans in the room chatted and paid little attention to either dog. Every few minutes, Tigger would lean forward and sniff Lassie's tail, then rock backward into the comfort of that secure attachment base I mentioned earlier. After a few minutes, without us forcing anything, Tigger got up and walked all the way over to Lassie's head, his confidence growing with each step. I kept Lassie on a downstay so that she didn't stand up and startle him, and Tigger sniffed her mouth, wagged his tiny little tail, and ran back to Mom. It was a perfect session. Rather than having his fears confirmed, Tigger had a secure place to run to when scared and wasn't presented with anything that was over his head. A few days after this session, his owner introduced him to another friendly, docile dog, and soon the two were romping like old friends. That's exactly the kind of experience that can turn genetically shy monkeys into normal adults, and it bears no relation to the just-throw-them-in-the-deep-end approach that many people take. That method can backfire on you more often than not. Just ask my family, who still laugh about the time I got thrown in the deep end. Literally. My mother took me to swimming classes, which turned out to be taught by a big ex-Marine kind of guy. Soon after we met, with little preparation, he swept me up and tossed me into the pool. I'm told I popped out of the water like a piece of toast out of a toaster and ran screaming across the lawn. All I remember is running away from the pool shrieking in fear, pursued by a huge red-faced man who was followed, cartoon style, by my distraught mother. Needless to say, I didn't learn much about swimming that day, and for a couple of years afterward, I avoided water whenever I could. That kind of experience in which an individual learns to be frightened by something is the third most common source of fearfulness, after genetics and lack of early experience. There's plenty to be afraid of out there in the world, and dogs can be permanently changed by traumatic events, just as people can. A good socialization plan should be designed to prevent traumatic experiences, not create them, so be thoughtful about where you take your puppy when you're out and about. Ideally, you're shooting for a balance between the right amount of exposure and stimulation and a sense of security and safety. As we've already seen, what balance is right for your pup is going to depend on his genetics and what kind of life you envision him living. Your best guide as to how to proceed is to use the signals described in Chapter 2 as a window into your dog's internal state, along with some thoughtful anthropomorphism and a dash of common sense. Blaze, the border collie, who hadn't been well socialized, is fine now, although I won't pretend it was easy getting there. It took a village of helpers and a tremendous amount of energy, but Blaze now greets visitors like long-lost friends and lives in a home with an active young owner and lots of other dogs to play with. Father Murray is happy, too. He rescued a sweet old dog who loves company as much as he loves Father Murray. We'll talk in the next chapter about how Blaze was rehabilitated, but next, we'll look at the third common origin of fear in dogs and people, trauma. Learning to be afraid. Lefty had been a friendly dog all his life, the dog everyone in the neighborhood knew and loved. An amiable Labrador, he loved nothing better than to play with the neighborhood kids on expansive suburban lawns. One summer, his family took a vacation unsuitable for dogs, so Lefty went to a friend's house. A week later, the family returned and picked him up. They were recounting this story to me in my office, and they stressed that he seemed fine, just fine, when they brought him home. He was a bit quiet, but he played a lot with other dogs at the neighbors, and his family assumed he was just tired. A week later, Lefty was outside in the backyard when one of his buddies, a 12-year-old boy, came over to say hello. As the child reached out to pet him, Lefty exploded in his face. The frightened child rocked backward as Lefty barked, bar-ar-ar-ar-ar, deep, growly barks that brought his owners running from the house. Lefty quieted as his family ran to him and the hapless boy withdrew, but everyone, the boy, Lefty's owners, and possibly Lefty himself, was shocked. Lefty and the boy had been friends for years, playing fetch under summer sunsets and sharing hamburgers at neighborhood picnics. His behavior seemed inexplicable. Lefty's barking and lunging toward the boy was so out of character, the family could barely believe it had happened. Perhaps, they thought, he'd been in pain for some reason and would have lashed out at anyone. They decided to watch him closely, but couldn't imagine such a thing happening again. It did. A few weeks later, Lefty lunged toward a 7-year-old boy, and a month after that, he cornered the plumber against the bathroom wall. By the time Lefty's family came to me, his behavior had deteriorated to barking aggressively toward any unfamiliar male, young or old. He hadn't bitten anyone yet, but his barks were deep and threatening, and the family was afraid of what he might do next. As we talked, Lefty greeted me exuberantly, bringing me tennis balls to throw and chew toys to admire. His body stayed loose and his mouth was relaxed, and for most of the hour he appeared as happy-go-lucky as he'd been for most of his life. But when a man walked by the office window, Lefty dropped the tennis ball he'd been carrying and lunged toward the man with deep, threatening barks. The hair over Lefty's shoulders stood straight up, his body became stiff and tight, his ears were pinned flat, and his eyes were round. Lefty may have been lunging forward, but if you looked at him closely, you could see that the corners of his mouth were pulled back in a fear grimace, and his pupils were fully dilated. Lefty's behavior may have been frightening, but Lefty was as scared himself as he was scary to others. The family was scared, too, and confused about why, after 6 years as their sweet, loving, easygoing best friend, Lefty had changed into a dog who was not only untrustworthy around strangers, but also jumpy and reactive to noises he'd previously ignored. We talked at length about what had happened in Lefty's life that could have precipitated his change in behavior, but couldn't come up with an explanation. Two veterinarians had carefully checked him for hidden health problems. Lefty had come up clean. The family hadn't changed his food or his routine, and nothing had happened at home that could explain his behavior. Finally, one of the children noted again how quiet he had been when he returned home from the neighbor's house. Looking for any insights into Lefty's behavior, I called them to find out whether anything could have happened while his family was away on vacation. The mystery began to resolve when they told me that a visiting relative had brought her 12-year-old son with her, and on one afternoon they had seen the boy teasing the dogs in the house. At one point, the boy trapped Lefty in the laundry room and taunted him by screaming in his face. Lefty, by all descriptions, had been terrified. Responsible dog lovers, the neighbors were appalled and put a stop to the abuse right away. To their relief, Lefty seemed none the worse for wear, happily greeting everyone who came to visit, playing politely, as always, with all the other dogs at the house. But none of the family were 12-year-old boys, and no one knew that the effects of trauma are not always visible on the surface, or that they can spread like ripples beneath the surface of a dog's future. Besides a genetic predisposition and a lack of exposure during development, the third reason that dogs are fearful is because they have learned to be. Perhaps one dog has learned that a rolled-up newspaper means she's going to get hurt. Another dog may have had a painful procedure at the veterinarian's and begins to pant and drool the next time the car pulls into the clinic's driveway. I've met dogs who loved other dogs, except individuals of just one breed or one color, who looked like the dog who attacked them when they were younger. These dogs may send them shaking behind their owner's legs or barking hysterically in a desperate attempt to keep the other dog away. Fear, derived from traumatic experiences, is actually less common than people imagine. Trainers and behaviorists see clients almost daily who say, "I'm sure she was terribly abused before I got her because she cowers, growls, snaps, hides at every man, stranger, dog she sees." Most often, these dogs are either genetically fearful, under-socialized, or most commonly, a bit of both. Shy dogs are often more afraid of men than of women, so a dog doesn't have to have been abused by a man to be fearful of all men. We don't know exactly why so many dogs are more afraid of men than of women, but it probably has to do with men's larger chests, larger jaws, lower voices, and tendency to approach assertively. However, sometimes dogs do get hurt and scared during their lifetimes, and these traumatic events can resonate through their lives just as they can through ours. We'll talk in the next chapter about what to do if that happens. But first, it's worth looking at how it happens in the first place. When people and dogs are frightened, parts of the limbic system, especially the hippocampus, record the details of the event like a detective at a crime scene. However, neither limbic systems or detectives know which of the details might be predictive of similar danger in the future, so they record whatever they can in case it turns out to be important later. A dog attacked by a big white dog may forever be afraid of white dogs because white was one of the features his brain recorded at the time. Another dog attacked by the same white dog as the first may remember size rather than color and be afraid of big dogs in the future. We know from brain activation research that when a person is terrified, the brain recruits input from neurons all over the brain, sweeping up both significant and insignificant details at the same time. For example, an entomologist who was hit by a car still remembers the species of insects flattened on the license plate as it rushed toward his head. Unable to sort out which details were related to the danger, the brain reacts emotionally to all of the information that was included in the sweep. Our entomologist friend will probably always react differently to the types of insects he associates with his car accident, even though they had nothing to do with the danger. One of the challenges when trying to turn around fearful behavior is to figure out what features were recorded as being relevant to the problem. These features, or triggers, become an important aspect of soothing the fear, as we'll see in the next chapter. How frightened a dog will be by any one event is driven in part by his genetics, in part by his experience during development, and also by the details of the event itself. Obviously, the intensity of the event makes a huge difference, just as it does with us. It's one thing to have a dog lunge at you and nip your hand before you know what hit you. It's another to be the victim of a long, drawn-out, injurious attack. However, how you or your dog experience the event isn't just a function of what happened. It's also dependent on your emotional state at the time. I just had a minor medical procedure that was about as risky and dramatic as eating warm oatmeal, yet I was trembling as if my life were in peril. The analytic part of my brain knew that was foolish, but my limbic system was on red alert. It had been primed by a terrifying incident in my car the night before, in which large sheets of particle board flew out of a trailer toward my windshield, requiring me to drive like a stunt woman in a James Bond movie to keep me and the dogs in my car alive. The physiological effects of an event like this one can take a long time to dissipate, and I could tell that my body was still full of stress hormones the next morning. Additionally, I went to the hospital with the knowledge that my father had died tragically after a similar medical procedure, in which one small accident led to a series of others, and ultimately to his death. The combination of factual knowledge about my father's death and the physiological arousal from the accident the night before turned me into a high-maintenance patient. The physician and CT scan technician get lots of points for bending over backward to soothe my irrational but deeply felt fears. Knowing that no amount of rational discussion was going to calm me, I stopped trying to talk myself out of being afraid. The only intellectual knowledge that helped was knowledge about the way the brain is wired. I remembered that there are fewer connections from the rational cortex of the brain to the limbic system than vice versa. Knowing that allowed me to stop trying to talk myself out of it and instead spend my energy doing what I did the night before, comfort myself with support from friends, deep breathing, and a whole heck of a lot of petting of dogs. Prior experience is an important factor in how a dog reacts to a frightening event. An attack by another dog is going to have much more impact if it happens to a pup who's never met another dog. That's why I was so worried about young Tigger. In contrast, Pip recovered from being jumped by a client's dog relatively quickly because she had had years of good experiences with other dogs. It also matters to dogs, just as it does to people, what happened in the days preceding an incident. Just as I was primed by being frightened in the car the night before my medical procedure, dogs can react differently depending on what has happened in their own recent past. A dog might react very differently to an attack if he'd been scared the night before by a thunderstorm or just been to the vets for vaccinations. The impact of the environment can be additive, which is one of the reasons that dogs seem to behave erratically. Perhaps your dog might welcome a guest one day and bark like a banshee at the same person the day after. Don't let some inconsistencies in your dog's behavior throw you. Many factors influence how frightened a dog will be by any one event. What has happened in his past is just one of them. Usually, the effects of any single incident fade away over a period of days, but on occasion, just as in people, one single incident is enough to change a dog forever. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in dogs. Some dogs are so affected by what happens to them, they behave as though they have been clinically traumatized. Someone rolled her eyes when I used this term in relation to dogs. She asked, her tone dripping with sarcasm, if I wasn't being just a little bit anthropomorphic when I used such a human term in relation to a dog. No, I replied, I wasn't, at least not in a problematic way. Trauma is defined as a serious shock or injury to the body or the emotions, an event that causes great distress and disruption. There's virtually nothing about the way dogs are designed to preclude their being distressed and disrupted by a terrifying event. As we've seen, dogs share the brain design and neurochemistry that influence fear and anxiety in humans. If we didn't, people wouldn't be continuing a line of perpetually terrified pointers to better understand how to treat generalized anxiety disorder in humans. That dogs can be frightened by something and that those fears can affect their behavior is hardly surprising to any of us who know dogs. What did surprise me was my gradual realization over the years that dogs exhibit many of the same symptoms as people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. Lefty, the dog whose story began this section, is a classic case of a dog who behaved much like a person with PTSD. As is often true in humans, his behavioral problems didn't begin immediately after he had been scared. Also, like a human PTSD victim, he began to generalize the triggers that he associated with his fear, first being afraid of just one 12-year-old boy, then of other boys of similar ages, and eventually of males of any age. That's often how trauma affects humans. Its effects aren't always obvious right away, and over time the victims begin to generalize their fears from one specific stimulus to wider and wider categories of events. An infamous story about the progression of trauma comes from the work of John B. Watson, the behaviorist mentioned in Chapter 1. Watson wanted to show the power of associative learning, in which an innate reaction to one thing, like the fear of a loud, startling noise, can be transferred to another thing, a benign object, such as a small furry animal. Watson brought Albert, an 11-month-old child, into his laboratory and sat him down in front of a friendly little white rat. Albert was charmed by the furry creature in front of him and cheerfully tried to pet it. However, every time Albert reached for the animal, Watson slammed a hammer onto a piece of metal just a few inches behind Albert's head. After one short session, poor little Albert burst into tears every time he saw a white rat. By the end of the week, he had become afraid of anything furry, including a rabbit and a fur coat. This experiment was heartless enough, given the knowledge of the time, but is made even more painful to contemplate by our current knowledge that Watson was permanently changing the function of Albert's brain and predisposing him to be far more reactive to trauma than he would have been before his unknowing mother brought him into the laboratory. Little Albert, the boy, and Lefty, the dog, have a lot in common. Both suffered from an event that was frightening, and in both cases a specific fear became generalized to anything that their brains had associated with the trauma. Albert started with an attraction to white furry animals, and Lefty to little boys. However, when these things were paired with something frightening, they became frightening all by themselves. Over time, both boy and dog began to generalize their fears, Albert to anything furry, Lefty to anyone male. Lefty was friendly to me not because I'm a trained behaviorist or because I love dogs, but simply because I'm not a guy. The bad news is that trauma can stay with us forever. Just ask the victims of war or other violence. We know this is true of many species besides ourselves. Rats who have been traumatized by inescapable shocks have long-lasting changes in their physiology and deficits in their ability to learn. Traumatic events can change the performance of an individual's amygdala, which, paired with its partner, the hippocampus, can carry memories of past dangers for a lifetime. One of the most common symptoms of PTSD in people is an increased level of reactivity to almost any stimulus that could possibly be associated with danger. I knew a Vietnam veteran who startled to any abrupt noise, literally throwing himself to the floor if a car backfired on the street below. His behavior and expressions were dead ringers for those of a client's traumatized golden retriever, who was the victim of a childhood prank. I don't know whether the kids who threw the firecracker meant it to land on the dog's back, but it did, a microsecond before it went off. Frito was terrified, and after that one incident, he responded to any loud, abrupt noise with panic, just as my friend did after being in combat. This hyperactivity is the result of what researchers call an overly efficient neural pathway between the amygdala, the hippocampus, and the hypothalamus, and the production of stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. In these cases, the brain lives in a state of chronic overarousal, which can inhibit the ability of the cortex to help the body decide what's dangerous and what isn't. This priming effect can result in some surprising findings, like that of one researcher who found that beagles had higher levels of cortisol when taken back to an area where they'd been shocked 1 month before than they did immediately after they received the shocks. That means that one entire month after being shocked, the poor dogs were more stressed about being taken back to the location than they were after the actual event. That's a perfect example of the results of trauma, in which a single event can have pervasive effects on an animal's emotions, and after which the fear worsens over time rather than improves. It's also a good example of how the brain does its best to record and remember things that are associated with fear or danger. The beagle's brains told them that the place was dangerous because they had been shocked there, even though the place itself actually had nothing to do with it. You might feel nervous when you hear a song that was playing on the radio when you had a car accident, although you won't even be conscious of the connection. Many of these associations are unconscious, but they probably drive our behavior as much as they do our dogs. There's good news, though, about trauma and its effect on people and dogs. For one thing, most frightening events don't result in clinical levels of trauma, and dogs can be as resilient as people can in recovering from a scare here and there. Being scared at the vet's office or being charged by a frightening dog isn't likely to cause lifelong problems in a healthy, stable dog, any more than one bad experience at the doctor's is going to leave you with a phobia about getting a physical. Of course, how you or your dog responds depends on the intensity of the experience and on whether you've been scared before in a similar situation or have a genetic predisposition toward an active amygdala. The other piece of good news about our reactions to frightening events is that as we start to understand more about the biology of fear, no matter what its source, we're also starting to develop better ways to treat fear. Some of these methods are dependent upon speech and are of no use to those of us with traumatized dogs. But other methods work without words and can do wonders for dogs whose fears are compromising their lives. That's the subject of the next chapter, in which we'll talk about tried and true methods that can help you help your dog overcome his fears.